I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our Summer Oncology Nursing Series. As today we talk about the management of advanced gynecologic cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Tom Herzog, a gynecologic oncologist from the University of Cincinnati, and Ms. Kim Speaks from the University of Arkansas Cancer Center. This is really a follow-up to the original ONS Congress satellite series that we've been doing for the last 14 years. In the last 2 years, we've done it virtually. This year, we did 11 programs, including a program on gynecologic cancer. Both Tom and Kim participated in this, as well as other docs and nurses presenting cases. One of the themes of our work is, why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient in the same oncology situation, but a different biopsychosocial background, different attitude, comorbidities, social support? And we'll get into that today with Kim's cases. Basically, Kim is going to present the cases and talk about patient education, particularly as relates to that patient, but also some of the biopsychosocial consideration in the patient as well. Tom will go through some of the oncology strategy thinking, how the docs sort of put together a plan for a patient based on clinical research results, FDA approvals, and their personal experience, and good ways to communicate that to patients. Here's where we're heading. Basically, we're going to make rounds today. We have five patients of Kim's we're going to talk about briefly and go from that into a discussion of sort of what's behind that. But just to sort of get warmed up a little bit, I want to talk about the fact that when we did this program in April, believe it or not, I actually conducted 27 one-on-one Zoom interview calls prior to that week that we did those programs with these nurse practitioners, including Kim. And where I want to begin is, I asked every one of these 27 nurse practitioners, oncology nurse practitioners, one question, the same one, and they all gave me the same answer. And I'm going to ask you, the audience, what your answer to the question is, because I kept hearing people say, you know, people always come up to me, not just the patients, but people, my friends and dinner parties, et cetera. And they say, why are you in oncology? Isn't it depressing? And so I want to start out with this question to you, audience. Has anyone ever asked you that question? And if so, when was the last time? I'm just kind of getting a feel. You know, I was really amazed that so many people answered positively to this interesting question. And here we go. Almost 90% of the audience has had somebody ask them that. And a quarter of the audience has had them asked this week, and another 15% this month. So, Kim, any thoughts about, first of all, I'm curious when the last time you heard that question yourself, Kim, and, you know, how you answer it. What is it that you find rewarding? And we can talk about taking care of yourself, exercise, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But what I want to just get your thoughts on is, what is it about your job that you find rewarding right now, Kim?
So I was actually asked this week, which is pretty common. I do get asked a lot. My patients, and I'm probably biased, are probably the best patients around. And I think that's just because of the type of situation they're in. And we do the best we can to make their situation more bearable. But they are very appreciative of everything we do. And also like oncology, because you learn something new every day, either scientifically, medically, or from the patient. So I'm always learning something, which is fantastic.
So Tom, when we did the original webinar, I asked you, and I think that day you'd had kind of a rough day, and I was so struck by your answer that at the end of the entire 11-part series, we played a couple of clips from. This is one of the ones we picked out. So we're going to play it again, but I want you just to elaborate a little bit more on what your thoughts were and what you were thinking about that day. Here's what you said on April 27th during the webinar.
We had a brutal clinic yesterday, and just, you know, in terms of some, you know, just patients that we all love have recurrences for, you know, where we're running out of options that we've been talking about. And I was over there today between surgeries, and they were still devastated from it. And we were talking about it. And so I think communicating is a big part of it, and being able to have an outlet that you can share this with. You don't keep it all bottled up, but the rewards are fantastic. When you see some of the things that, you know, we heard from those presentations today of really where they pulled life out of death, that's an amazing experience. And it makes you feel really proud to be part of that. And in the case of my colleagues today, that, you know, we've all been part of trials. I mean, they're bringing drugs to these patients that are helping thousands at a time, not just one patient at a time. And that's extremely rewarding too. But there is a need for all the caregivers to take care of themselves better than what we do.
So I think, Tom, everyone in the audience could just relate so much to the way you were feeling that day and the, you know, the fact that you're going over there to sort of be with your colleagues. Anything else you want to say about what it is that you like about being in oncology, Tom?
Yeah, well, what I do is particularly rewarding too, because I think we get a lot of the immediate gratification out of doing the surgical aspect of it. So our medical oncology colleagues don't necessarily have that part of it. So that part's very good, but that comes at a price too, because there's stress when things don't go as they should in a surgical procedure or in the post-operative course. That's very upsetting as well, because you feel like you had a very direct hand in the consequences that occurred. So, but I generally get more satisfaction out of the surgeries than dissatisfaction. So that's another part that's very helpful. And also for me, as I emphasize, being part of clinical trials and feel that in feeling that you're making the field move forward, however small that is, but just in the forward direction, I think gives some solace to when you see someone who you really care about who's passed away, or you have to give them that kind of news. So for me, that's really helpful to have those two aspects of my career. Rather than just having a 40-patient clinic 5 days a week, I'd find that pretty devastating.
So, Kim, curious about how your thoughts about being involved with clinical research. Of course, being in a tertiary center like you are, you have that available. I'm curious how patients respond to it. You know, it wasn't that long ago, sort of when all we had was chemotherapy, that clinical trials, you know, was not very likely that the patient was going to benefit. Maybe they're going to help future patients. Now with these novel agents, you see people who go on trials and they do well. And in some cases, you know, maybe they wouldn't have had the opportunity to get the treatment. Any thoughts about how you feel about being involved with research and how your patients respond?
Yeah, so for the most part, our patients pretty well take to clinical trials. The ones that don't are the ones that feel like it's a last resort and we're just kind of throwing it at them because we have nothing else, which is not always the case. But I enjoy it because you can actually see something, like Dr. Herstock said, you see something that we didn't have 5 years ago and now we're watching it work on people. So that is impressive. And I've been doing this almost 15 years, so it's come a long way in that time. That we didn't think would. And then a lot of our patients are saying, oh, is that drug I saw on TV? So they are actually more educated from watching the commercials, especially about immunotherapy. So they get excited when it's something that they've heard about too. So that helps.
So we're going to get into the cases next, but I just want a final question. And just again, in terms of patients responding to research, Tom, I'm curious about, you know, it's been interesting to watch how people respond to the idea of vaccination. And you realize there are a lot of people out there who have a distrust of science out there, which, you know, you can understand, if particularly if they're not used to that. What are some of the spectrum of how people do respond to clinical trials? And do you find people who, you know, maybe kind of aren't trusting enough to go in a trial?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, if you look at the whole issue of health disparities, and there's certainly certain populations where that sentiment is more prevalent than what you see in other populations. And so, and rightfully earned in many cases, right? In terms of there being substandard care or experimentation, if you go back decades. And so those are barriers that we need to overcome. First of all, be aware that they're there, but really overcome them. The whole guinea pig thing is a big one that I think is really a big barrier that I think that the first thing I do in terms of trying to educate patients is explain what a clinical trial is, and what the advantages are of actually having better care and more monitoring and that type of thing than what you would get. And the best trials, of course, the easiest ones to enroll to are where you're getting standard of care plus as an option. The hard ones are where you're, you know, we've had some of those in our field where we've had, you know, you can get an extra year's worth of therapy versus nothing. So people have trouble processing that, and the enrollment rate certainly reflected that. So, but I think we need a lot of education in terms of the barriers to enrollment, and it will help with some of our health inequities.
And, you know, when you look at what we're going to talk about today, and, you know, in terms of ovarian cancer, we talk about PARP inhibitors, we're going to show the trials. Those women who were in those original trials are still benefiting from it. We're going to talk about immunotherapy. Again, you can see in those trials great results in some patients. And again, the patients who were on the earlier trials were getting a therapy that was not available to other people. There are lots of people walking around right now alive and well because of clinical trials. But let's get into how this is playing out in a community-based setting, or, you know, how it would play out. These first two cases are perfect examples of how clinical research has really led to dramatic changes in the upfront management of ovarian cancer. So we're going to start out with this 52-year-old lady. Kim, can you kind of sort of provide sort of a snapshot of what her situation was when she presented, how she did present?
Yeah, so she was diagnosed at age 50. She presented with abdominal pain, which is pretty typical of our patients. Went into the emergency room, was found to have a pelvic mass, did have surgery, found to have ovarian cancer, actually, I think fallopian tube cancer. And then we tested her tumor at that time and was found to have a somatic mutation.
So, Tom, before we get into the slides, I just kind of want to talk a little bit. I mean, we always kind of pattern our work around rounds where people kind of explain things verbally. And a lot of times, sometimes that's easier to understand than going through a lot of complicated slides. You can check out our slide set, and we're going to show most of the slides today. But I guess one big difference in terms of, you know, at least the initial evaluation of a patient with ovarian cancer is that nowadays, as opposed to, I don't know, like 2-3 years ago, it is standard that these women are going to have their genomic profiles done. And you have the option of looking at germline mutations that go throughout all cells of the body, as well as somatic mutations. That's what this woman has, which is just in the tumor and not in the rest of the cells. And this woman had a BRCA somatic mutation. So, Tom, what is the standard approach in terms of the type of testing you do when a woman walks through the door with ovarian cancer? Does it depend on the stage, or everybody gets this testing, and what kind of testing do they get?
Yeah, so virtually everyone receives the testing, and where we are, we usually start with sending the tumor to get that information back, you know, the big question is how many of the germlines would you miss if you just relied on the somatic, where you can miss occasionally a mutation that's there. So we had often been doing germline as well, or they have come with germline already. But at the very minimum, you'd want to know germline at the very minimum because of cascade testing and identifying a risk of cancer for this patient in the future in other disease sites, as well as her relatives. So for me, that would be something that I would insist on if there were resource issues or anything like that, is at least getting a germline. The beauty of the somatic is you add in, so say, you know, you have that 14-15% that would test positive for germline, and then you get the somatic and you pick up another 5-7%. And this is a great example. If you just did germline, you would have missed this mutation. And she's BRCA2, which is the mutation that responds the very best to treatment. So I think for me, I need to know that information if we're not constricted financially.
And Kim, of course, you know, up until recently, the rationale to do this type of testing, specifically the germline testing, was really to be able to protect the family. You know, if they have, for example, a BRCA germline mutation and that's passed on to someone in the family, they're going to be at high risk for a variety of tumors, particularly breast and ovarian. Many people will choose that preemptive surgery and have their breasts removed or ovaries and tubes removed. And really, you prevent a cancer from occurring in the same model that you do when you do colonoscopy and pick up a premalignant lesion. But it also has, you know, pretty profound implications to a family. I'm curious, when you do pick up a BRCA, I guess we should say this is done regardless of family history. Plenty of people have BRCA mutations that don't have family histories, but now you're involving the family. I'm curious how that dynamic plays out, how patients and families respond when you say, hey, Maybe we need to get you to have your family talk to a genetic counselor.
Yeah, so a lot of times the patient that has cancer has a lot of guilt with that. And so there's a lot of education and, you know, talking to them saying, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, but they do have a lot of guilt initially. But yeah, we always educate them on the risk of it, send them to the, for if it's BRCA, send them to high risk breast. We have a clinic that's actually, we share the waiting room so they can see all of us kind of at the same time, which is nice. And then we try to get all the family members that want to get tested, we go ahead and test them as well.
And what's really great is with this trend towards, and think about this question while we're talking for you audience, you can vote on this one. Here's a statement. Bevacizumab is particularly effective in patients with ovarian cancer who have ascites or pleural effusion. Agree or disagree with that? But thinking back to what you were just talking about in terms of, you know, the impact on the family in this situation, you know, there, if you think about it, we've seen many cases of people who maybe they were going to die of ovarian cancer and yet their family member is going to have it completely prevented because they were aware of that there was this mutation. This is another issue that's very relevant. Bevacizumab has been studied and utilized in ovarian cancer for quite a while. And most of the audience, almost all, is aware of the fact, Tom, that it's very interesting, particularly you see in ovarian cancer, that it does seem to have a specific effect in people who have ascites or pleural effusion. Any thoughts about how this plays out in practice and why it is that Bev, an anti-angiogenic, can help sort of dry up effusions?
Yeah, I think, you know, it goes to the access or the axis that it works on in terms of the pathway. You know, it binds the ligand, the VEGF, and apparently that's a big part of forming the ascites or pleural effusion, those fluids that we see. I had a patient recently that had literally 14 liters of fluid on her abdomen. And needless to say, we made sure that Bev was part of her regimen.
And we'll talk in a second because in addition to that, you know, clinical issue, there's also a fact that the fact that Bev can be part of reducing the risk of recurrence. And we're going to show a trial where PARP inhibitors was actually combined, the so-called Paola study, with bevacizumab and actually seem to have an even greater effect. Here's another question just for the audience to think about. We know you know the answer. We're just trying to get you more engaged. So audience, postoperative after chemotherapy, maintenance therapy with a PARP inhibitor is now standard of care in a patient like Kim's who has either a germinal, a somatic or germline mutation. Do you agree with that? Is everybody with one of these mutations going to get a PARP inhibitor recommended? And again, you know, the audience is right on target, Tom, in terms of that. What about the patients who don't have BRCA mutations? We know they have, we'll show in a second, you know, tremendous responses, but there are other germline mutations out there that are thought to be similar to BRCA. There are other somatic mutations out there. Beyond BRCA, what are the situations where you think about a PARP inhibitor, Tom? Do you think about it in someone who has no evidence of any mutation? We saw some, you know, pretty significant benefit with the drug niraparib in those patients.
That's right. So, you know, you had a hazard ratio in PRIMA of 0.68. But what it does highlight, Neil, in my opinion, is getting back to the testing question. So I said, you know, I definitely would want to know germline and somatic. But in reality, when we do the multi-omics testing platform, we receive LOH. And that's to me a very important piece of information because you now can get up a little over 50% of patients that clearly benefit significantly from a PARP inhibitor. So if you look at the hazard ratios for those that are HRD or homologous recombination deficient, and what that means is that you have, as Neil said, either other mutations or you have a loss of heterozygosity and genomic instability across the genome that confers the same type of susceptibility to knocking out the base excision repair pathway with PARP. And so what that does, because there's already a defect in the double-strand DNA repair, is it makes the cell very susceptible to cell death when exposed to a PARP. And so if you just know the germline, as I said, about 15%, then you get up a little over 20%. But you can now get over 50% if you find out those that are HRD. And I was referring to the hazard ratio, which is the difference between the control arm and the experimental arm with the PARP, where you see on the order of, 70% reduction, for example, or more if they have a BRCA mutation. Well, if you look at those that have homologous recombination deficiency, it's an almost a 60% reduction in the hazard of progression or risk. So having that piece of information for me really is important in terms of trying to make sure that those patients are at least giving PARPs a try. I'll talk to PARPs to all patients in terms of even those that are HR proficient that lack this characteristic. But for someone who has HRD or has a mutation, I will really try to sell it because I think it makes such a difference in their potential outcome.
I guess the important message here is there is no controversy about what to do via BRCA. There is controversy about the other patients. Bevacizumab is another issue that comes up. Some patients, particularly if they don't have any mutations, might just get Bev and no PARP inhibitor by some docs. Although, as Tom said, you can find pretty good evidence for almost any patient benefiting from PARP inhibitor with ovarian cancer. But another issue, Kimberly, that comes up is, because sometimes people have the thought that, well, there's oral therapy, it's a pill, no big deal. But as we know in general in oncology, just because it's oral doesn't mean there are tolerability issues. And one of the things that comes up, and here's another question for you to think about, audience, again, just to keep you involved, which is the duration of treatment in the trial. So usually we follow what the trials do, we follow. And a decision was made that when the, you can call it adjuvant, post-surgery, post-chemotherapy trial of olaparib was done, they decided to use it for 2 years. I mean, nobody knows. It could have been one. It could have been five. They picked two. And for the niraparib trial that we're going to talk about, they used 3 years. And it looks like, again, most of the audience is familiar with that. And I'm just kind of curious, Kim, what's it like to keep somebody on a PARP inhibitor for a couple of years? What are some of the tolerability issues that come up and how you usually deal with that?
Yeah, I always start out telling patients just because it's a pill, it is not a benign drug. So you still have side effects. So the biggest ones that I've experienced, and I think it's probably pretty standard, is going to be fatigue. And I tell patients, I don't have a magic pill to fix fatigue. I can fix almost any other side effect with the medication, but not fatigue. I tell them lots of fluid, good nutrition, rest when you can. And then we just dose reduce if the fatigue gets too bad. Nausea can be a little bit of an issue. Most of that's pretty well controlled with antiemetics. So that's not, I've never had to dose reduce anybody due to nausea, but I have due to fatigue. And then blood counts is another thing. So we watch those pretty closely, especially initially. But I do tell all my patients, if you can hang out for 2 to 4 weeks, those side effects may be more tolerable at that point. So we don't rush it to dose reduce at the very beginning. I kind of try to get them to wait it out a little bit longer.
So Tom, the other issue that's been discussed, and of course, PARP inhibitors are now potentially a part of the menu in breast cancer and prostate cancer and pancreatic cancer. And actually breast cancer just a couple months ago had a very important paper, kind of similar to the strategy, not exactly the same, but similar to the strategy in ovarian cancer, big positive trial in the adjuvant and post-neoadjuvant setting. So Tom, now we're looking at in the medical oncology platform, breast cancer patients starting to potentially fall into the same pathway as ovarian cancer, particularly in terms of testing. And certainly the higher risk patients with breast cancer nowadays, same thing that you just described is about to happen in breast cancer as of June. So people are kind of trying to deal with that. But one of the things that comes up, Tom, particularly in the adjuvant situation where, I mean, there are people who get cured, for example, at ovarian cancer without PARP inhibitors, just by surgery and chemotherapy. Of course, it's dramatically improved, at least the relapse rate by using a PARP inhibitor. But anytime you have a situation where some of the patients are at and really don't even need the therapy, even though maybe a small number, is the possibility of long-term side effects. And Kim mentioned the fact you can see bone marrow effects with these agents, anemia, for example. And it has been thought that there may be and maybe is a slight increased risk of AML and MDS. Initially, when we saw this in the patients who were treated for advanced disease, they had gotten a lot of chemotherapy, so the rates were higher even in the control group. But it looks like now in these new trials that are using it earlier where they haven't had as much chemo, it's less, and I'm not even sure it's there. But I'm curious, trying to put all this together, Tom, how you explain it to a patient.
Yeah, it's a really important aspect because, as we all know, if you get MDS, it's largely incurable. And nothing more upsetting than you have someone who's a potential long-term cure and then they develop MDS. So in terms of counseling, you know, the information that we have right now, it's been the updates from, as you alluded to, those platinum-sensitive maintenance trials that really led the way, that sort of astonished us a little bit, because we saw with SOLO2 for olaparib that the MDS-AML rate was 8%. And then we really have pretty much the same thing. I mean, remember, all those patients in SOLO2 were BRCA mutated. So then if you look at the BRCA mutated group in NOVA with niraparib, we see the same thing. We see about 6.6%, so almost 7%. So you're seeing 7-8% rate of MDS-AML. Now, as you pointed out, they've had a lot more chemotherapy as well, and platinum damaging drugs such as cisplatin and carboplatin are a big part of that. So, you know, it's hard to separate out completely and just say it's the PARP, because there's been a lot of crossover and that type of thing. Even patients that were in the control arm from a lot of these studies received PARP subsequently. So a lot of that needs to be teased out. What's reassuring, though, is that so far, at least with SOLO1, and we have 5-year results right now, at the 5-year mark, the MDS rate was still relatively low at like 1 to 2%. So that's somewhat reassuring. I think we'll need longer term follow up on that, but that's good news.
And, you know, this is not the first time we've seen this in oncology. If you think about multiple myeloma, we started to see several years ago lenalidomide maintenance, which is given to everybody almost. Is associated with the increased risk of second cancer, but the benefit is outweighs it. And that's the same thing you see here. Yes, it's there, but when you look at these curves, they're much more likely to avoid death from or recurrence from ovarian cancer than they are to develop MDS, but certainly something that a patient needs to be informed about. Well, let's come back to this same patient that Kim has, a 52-year-old. We've kind of talked about her the way people typically do in education conferences, focusing on the stage and symptoms and treatment. Now we're going to kind of take a minute or two to talk about why was it different to take care of this particular woman compared to somebody else who had the same age, same stage, same treatment. And Kim, what are some of the things about this lady that made it different to take care of her?
So she has a pretty significant medical history of comorbidity. She has a history of cerebral palsy. She's had a stroke. She has some depression and anxiety, diabetes. So at baseline, on paper especially, she doesn't sound real healthy. She was actually able to ambulate pretty well. Her biggest thing was she had fatigue at baseline. So we had to kind of, you know, talk a lot about, when I say you're going to have fatigue, I need to know, is it different than your baseline? She also didn't have a very great social support system, so that was a little bit of a struggle. She does have home health coming in with AIDS, but as far as family, she doesn't have a great support system, so that's been a little bit of a challenge.
So, Tom, any thoughts about this history that you just heard? How would some of these factors affect the way you manage the patient? This patient previously had a stroke.
Yeah.
She has a long history of cerebral palsy, yet she seems to be pretty vibrant. She's certainly very motivated. She's doing well on therapy. Anything you want to say about what you heard about this? And anything about the issue of fatigue that you see? You've already talked about it. This patient had it. There are a lot of different reasons for fatigue. How you think through sort of evaluating somebody who's talking about being fatigued?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge with fatigue is that it's multifactorial. And it runs everything from the medications we give, from the deconditioning we induce, all the way to the psychosocial stress that's present because you're living with cancer. And then when you throw in some of the particulars for this patient in terms of not having the best support system and some of these other issues, It's hard to figure out, you know, the main cause of the fatigue very often. It is without a doubt, though, one of the more common side effects that we see associated with PARP inhibitors. So, you know, I encourage my patients to try to get on some type of exercise program because I think it reduces the stress. It builds up stamina, and patients generally sleep better, which I think is a big part of this. So that's what I try to do is make sure they're nutritionally sound and that they're getting exercise and so forth. Well, the one thing that you did say that would bear in terms of oncology strategy with this patient is her history of stroke. For example, we would probably be reluctant if it was a thrombolic stroke to go with bevacizumab because that increases that risk significantly. So these types of things do affect your treatment strategy as you move forward.
And here are the big trials. These are so-called phase 3 studies that compare one approach to another. And you can see the SOLO-1 trial had 451 patients in it. And you can see the other numbers. There are a lot of patients. SOLO-1 looked at olaparib. Paola looked at olaparib plus bevacizumab. And then the PRIMA study looked at niraparib. And one of the differences there is in the SOLO study, it was just people with BRCA. In the PRIMA study, it was all comers, and then they tried to sort of look at that after the fact. VILLE was another huge study that was presented around that time of another PARP inhibitor, which sort of seemed to go away since then because it really didn't seem to present any advantages or anything specific that would be useful. We've been seeing updates of these trials. This is the update of the SOLO trial. The top line is the patients who got olaparib. The bottom line is the ones who don't, and so that you can see that the chance at 5 years of being without recurrence is 48% versus 21%. We've talked a lot about the hazard rate in trials. If you look over to the right there, you see HR 0.33. We talk whenever you see a trial that has HR there, what it means is you subtract 33 from 100, you get 77. And at any point in time, there's a 77% difference in these two curves. So the chance of having a relapse is reduced 77%. So one of the biggest advances we've seen in oncology. This is some more data that was just presented at the ASCO meeting in June from the niraparib trial, the PRIMA study, looking specifically at patients who if you look at the top, who were in that trial, who had BRCA mutations like the patients who were also in the SOLO trial. And there were two other trials that looked at BRCA patients. Bottom line is kind of hard to separate out the PARP inhibitors when you look at these things. There are differences in terms of how the trials are done. This is a study that looked at combining Bev and PARP inhibitors. Again, you see a big difference between those who got the combination versus those who didn't. Tom, right now, what are the situations where you do think about combining Bev with a PARP inhibitor in a patient with primary ovarian cancer?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that comes into focus for most of our patients who have HRD. It's probably the preferred strategy. I think the one issue, you know, if you go back and look at that SOLO-1 curve, what's amazing to me is the control arm on that. Those are the patients that prognostically are supposed to do extremely well. So these are patients with BRCA who did not receive a PARP inhibitor, and look how steep that curve goes down. And I think that's really amazing. And Neil, I'll often hear from people that these PARPs work in the platinum sensitive setting. They even work as treatment later on. So why give a PARP up front to these patients? And this is my answer right here. So many of those patients are going to recur as platinum resistant patients within that first 6 months. So, you know, you've changed the natural history for them tremendously if you get them to recur a year or two out, because now they have so many more options in terms of the options you have for platinum sensitive disease versus platinum resistant. So I think that's really, really important to point out. And then the curve you were just showing was the data for the Bev plus olaparib and the high risk and low risk groups. And again, so people have tried to use Bev to decide that I'm only going to use it in quote unquote high risk groups. And here you see the lower risk group actually had the lower hazard ratio. 0.21 versus 0.66. All good, and yeah, they're non-analytical endpoints, but still very interesting data in my mind, because you're really seeing that that group benefited from a PARP plus Bev more so. And it goes against our conventional wisdom of only treating those that are high risk with ascites and with pleural effusions.
So just a word about your other case, Kim, because tragically, this is really a woman who, where this all could have been prevented, a 59-year-old woman who was a nurse, as well as her mm-hmm. spouse being a nurse, who got breast cancer at the age of 32 and did not have a genetic testing, was later on, got chemotherapy surgery. This patient then developed ovarian cancer. Can you just sort of summarize what happened with her? And why was it, I guess in those days, not necessarily people were getting tested with breast cancer. Nowadays, she for sure would have been tested. But right. I guess this lady, even when she knew she was BRCA, didn't want to have preventive surgery.
Right. So I asked her why she never got tested, even when it became more standard of care. And she said, well, I just figured I was going to be positive. So what was the point in getting the test? And I said, well, because you could have possibly prevented this disease. But we have her on maintenance olaparib. She's done well. We did have to dose reduce due to neutropenia. She's done very well. I still can't get her to go to high risk breast to talk about getting the other side done. Because she only had unilateral mastectomy at the time of her diagnosis. But she's doing well, so I can't talk her into going to high risk breast though.
Well, you know, there's, of course, an important principle in oncology is involving the patient. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have the right to make these decisions, and that's their choice. Mm-hmm. And it should be their choice. Let's go on now and talk a little bit about endometrial cancer. And I guess we're going to talk about advanced disease. We're going to present two cases from Kim. But I want to start out with this question to the audience, just for you to think about. You can answer as well. Here's a statement. You tell me you agree or disagree with it. Checkpoint inhibitors are approved for and commonly used in cervical and endometrial cancer, but not ovarian cancer. So we just talked about ovarian cancer. And I guess, Tom, one of the, again, the audience is right on target there, knowing that we're about to talk about checkpoint inhibitors in cervical and endometrial. We are not talking about it much in ovarian cancer. Kind of really frustrating, Tom, that so far we haven't been able to find an answer, at least in terms of immunotherapy in ovarian cancer. Incidentally, before we start getting into where we are right now, Tom, do you see this changing for ovarian cancer? You think immunotherapy is going to come into it?
Well, so far we've had three phase three trials that have failed, which is really unfortunate. Javelin 100, 200, and then Atezo failed as well in frontline ovary. So remains to be seen. We have another shot on goal, if you will, coming up with Athena, which is rucaparib plus nivolumab. It's four arms, randomized 4-4 to 1-1 to try to get the contribution effect of both those drugs. So we may have data pretty soon on that. I'm hoping in the next 6 months or so, we'll see some, at least the data on arms one versus arms two.
So we were talking about breast cancer before and PARP, and breast cancer, similarly, you know, very little going on in terms of immunotherapy. Now it is approved and used in metastatic triple negative breast cancer. Yeah. But not the kind of results like what we're about to talk about with endometrial cancer. And as you said, we're seeing a lot of trials that combine PARP and IO immunotherapy in ovarian cancer. There's some hints that maybe that'll be better, but we'll see. So here's a situation that really wasn't in oncology 5 years ago, MSI high disease. And we'll talk about what that is, but this is a 68-year-old woman with a recurrent endometrial cancer who had the MSI high variation of endometrial cancer. Kim, how did she present and what happened to her?
So her initial presentation, of course, like most endometrial cancer, she had postmenopausal bleeding. So she had surgery. She was early stage. So we recommended brachytherapy after completion of her surgery. Unfortunately, about 4 months later, she presented with a nodule on her abdominal wall. So that was biopsied, proven to be recurrence, and she had widely metastatic disease on CT scan. We gave her chemotherapy. She progressed after six cycles of chemotherapy, so then we switched her to pembrolizumab due to her MSI high on her tumor. And she got a total of 33 cycles, but even after 6 months of treatment, her scan had minimal disease at that point. And now she's had complete response, even a year and a half later off of treatment, it still has a negative scan.
So really an amazing story, but you know, we see this every day nowadays, fortunately. Yeah. I'm kind of curious, of course, when you talk about immunotherapy, you have potentially autoimmune toxicity. Anything from pneumonitis, we'll talk about that. Anything that ends in an itis, people say you can see. How about this lady? Any problems at all?
The only thing she had was she had a rash, and it wasn't even a full body rash. She would have it pop up on her leg, and then she treated it with some steroid ointment. She'd have it on her arm, treated with steroid ointment, but never a full body rash and no other issue. She actually tolerated it very well.
So when this lady was treated, Kim, pembrolizumab was typically used every 3 weeks. Subsequently, right in the middle of the pandemic, very good timing, they came out with data showing you can give a higher dose every 6 weeks. Of course, she was treated, but she was treated for 2 years. So you would think that maybe that might have been an option. And now, again, with COVID, trying to keep everybody, people out of the hospital. How are you approaching this issue of 3 versus 6 weeks, Kim?
So we're kind of leaving it up to the patient. You know, it depends. A lot of our patients have a hard time getting here on a regular basis. So if they live far away, especially, we'll recommend the every 6 week. We're still doing every 3 week for some patients. It really kind of depends on their situation and how often they're willing to come. So
Tom, we have patients who either are so-called MSI high or MSI stable, which is really the majority of patients. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you explain to patients what MSI actually is and what it means in terms of therapeutic implications.
Yeah, so microsatellites are short repeating segments or sequences of DNA. And when you say someone is a microsatellite high, what they're talking about is they have a high number of mutations in those sequences. And so they have a cutoff of 30% or so. And if it's higher than that, they're defined as being MSI high or microsatellite unstable. So that basically what it boils down to, if you look at the end product of having that pattern of DNA mutations in those microsatellites, is that these cells have a hard time hiding from the immune system, harder time. And that confers an advantage, especially if you give them an immuno-oncology drug.
You know, it's interesting too, because I think maybe the first area where MSI really started to pop up and we talked about was colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And there they've actually done some big studies and shown that immunotherapy is actually better than chemotherapy. Less recurrences, better survival. I don't think that kind of comparison has been done you can correct me if I'm wrong, with endometrial, but still the typical therapy is immunotherapy alone, just like this lady got pembrolizumab.
It's actually in MSI. The pipeline. Yep. People are thinking about it. Yep. Designing right. That type of trial.
And then also, you see it in other cancers rarely, but important to look for, because if you do find a patient who has it, they're exquisitely sensitive. I mean, listen to the story that you just heard with this patient. It's not every patient who has that. Some people don't even respond, but to see something like this with metastatic disease is amazing. But let's look at the other side of this story, Kim, the more common situation where the tumor is MS stable. This is a 64-year-old woman, and as we'll talk about there, what we've actually seen is that immunotherapy also can be effective, maybe not quite as effective as, or not as effective as MSI disease. But there, what we've seen is we didn't see that much action when we just gave the immunotherapy alone. But as is being done in a number of other cancers, when you add a tyrosine kinase inhibitor in this case, lenvatinib, you see pretty good responses, but also a lot of tolerability problems. But this strategy of combining an IO, a PD-1 agent, and a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, for example, renal cell cancer, the three different regimens that are all now utilized first line like this. So there's some magic. We'll ask Tom in a second what he thinks it is about bringing this combination together. But first, let's hear what happened to this lady. And when she did, she ended up getting a treatment with pembrolizumab, and to hear what happened.
Yeah, so she was diagnosed with high-stage papillary serous endometrial cancer, surgery, followed by chemotherapy, unfortunately recurred about a year later, had bone mets at that point, got some radiation to that area, then followed by some chemotherapy, progressed again, not very shortly after that. So then we started on pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. She tolerated it not real great. She had blood pressure issues, and she also had elevated TSH, and we had to start her on levothyroxine. And unfortunately, she progressed after only 3 months on treatment.
So Tom, just to talk a little bit about this regimen, and this lady seemed to have complications from both of the drugs, and I think it's important to try to maybe figure out which drug it is that's causing the problem. So she ended up having hypertension, I guess, as soon as she started to get therapy that needed to be treated. And then she became hypothyroid, which you would think would be related to immunotherapy. It's a known side effect of immunotherapy. What do you typically see with these patients, Tom, and how do you respond in terms of dose reduction when you see complications like this?
So the contribution effect in terms of the toxicity when you're giving multiple agents is always a bit of a dilemma. In this case, she typifies what you most commonly see. So the most common side effect for the lenvatinib is the hypertension. We do home blood pressure monitoring and everything else. And I guess the biggest thing that we face really is, you know, what dose do you start at? And Kim, I don't know what you do in Arkansas, but for us, you know, I sort of look at the history of the patient. Does she already have hypertension? How frail is she? Those types of things. What condition is she in? And I start usually at 14 if they're pretty frail. Otherwise, I start at 18. I know other people who argue that you should start at 20, which is the approved dose, and just dial down. I have a trouble chasing toxicity sometimes, and the patients become disillusioned. And especially with an oral medication, I worry about compliance then if they're starting to have problems. We have seen some nausea and vomiting with lenvatinib too. Not unlike the PARPs, played around with when to take it and things like that, and food and so forth. The thyroid issues, you can have hypo or hyperthyroidism with the IOs, and it's the most common one that I encounter, at least clinically. So it's nice in this particular case, at least you kind of know which of the agents you can adjust the dose, reduce, or hold, especially with the IOs. I hold them, and then, you know, if it's grade 3, grade 4, unfortunately, you need to discontinue them in many cases.
So, you know, again, you know, we hear people saying if it ends in itis, Kim, you can see it with a checkpoint inhibitor. I just saw a paper on hearing loss, which I never heard about with IOs. But anyhow, I guess you can have an inflammation. As we talked about, I'm curious, what are some of the things you bring up to patients who are starting immunotherapy, Kim, in terms of what to look out for? What are some of the things you're concerned about making sure you pick up early?
Yeah, I actually do tell them any itis is a potential side effect. So I actually tell them anything that is abnormal to call, and then we'll tell them if that's from the IO or not. But the biggest things I tell them is colitis, so to look for diarrhea, abdominal pain, especially bloody diarrhea, pneumonitis, shortness of breath, cough, chest pain. Those are probably the biggest two that I do the most education about, just because they're a little more serious than some of the other ones. And of course, a rash, because they can see the rash a lot easier. So
Tom Mayer in the chat room was curious about the histology of Kim's patient. She had papillary serous carcinoma of the endometrium. Wants to know, do you treat patients with endometrial cancer differently, particularly in the metastatic setting, based on the histologic subtype?
Yeah, great question. What's interesting is that we've done some molecular studies, and despite them looking very similar under the microscope, molecularly there's quite a few differences. They all tend to have p53, but beyond that, there's some unique patterns that appear to be a little bit different. So we're a little confounded in how we treat UPSC, because initially we do treat it very similar to ovarian cancer, but in recurrence we do not. So in the initial stages, we will give platinum and a taxane. We usually don't give Bev in those cases. And we don't have a lot of data on PARPs, although we have some data emerging for PARP inhibitors in endometrial. We don't have any data specifically that I'm aware of on large numbers of UPSCs. So it's not part of the standard of care. When patients recur, they tend to get treated. If we look at the data that came out from PEM-LEN, they included patients that were high risk, including these types of patients, and they responded well. So I think we feel pretty confident in treating them with an IO, which is different than what we do, again, with the ovarian cancer patients. So we, while similar under the microscope, there's probably more differences that we appreciate.
So we're going to finish out in a second talking about cervical cancer and one of the most exciting developments in oncology, period, in a second. But first, just to take a look at some of the slides in the slide deck relevant to what we're talking about. We're talking about this combination of lenvatinib, pembrolizumab. And you can look, I think we've talked about what a waterfall plot is. Each one of these sticks represents a patient. If it's going down, it means the tumor is shrinking. If it's going up, it's progressing. And you can see that these MS stable patients that we've been talking about are blue. There are a few MSI high patients in here. You can see they almost all go down, the red bars there, but you know, pretty good waterfall plot. And then this is a subsequent study of a lot more patients, and they saw a significant benefit. Again, maybe not the level of what's seen with MSI high disease, but very significant benefit. Many people responding. And you know, this is an interesting study, Tom, looking at the issue of a lot of these patients will require dose reduction. The standard of 20 milligrams, I think not that many patients end up on. And it looks like you're not losing very much when you do dose reduce. Is that your impression, Tom?
It is. The only caution with this SGO paper that came out this March was that, the numbers are pretty small. So that's the only thing. So to say there's no difference when the numbers are small is cautionary. But, I've had responders at 14. So
one other thing about endometrial cancer I want to mention, there's a bunch of, obviously, checkpoint inhibitors approved in oncology. At one point, there were five approved in bladder cancer. But we now have another one approved in endometrial cancer, dostarlimab, which was approved in April. A PD-1 inhibitor, as the typical mechanism involved. You can see the benefits look pretty similar to what we were just showing you, mainly in MSI high diseases, which is where it's approved. On the left, you see the patients who are MS stable, and you see the duration of responses. Each one of these sticks is a response, but right now being looked at more in MSI high disease. But we have this trial cooking, so to speak, the Ruby trial, Tom. What are they looking at with this agent? When do you think we're going to get an answer? And how do you think this might affect what we're going to be doing in the future?
Yeah, it's a confirmatory trial. And this type of trial, can change care in the sense of now you're going to move it up the front line in terms of the checkpoint. And that's important. First of all, you have a lot of patients who, because of toxicity or whatever reasons, are unable to get secondary or tertiary therapies. So it's important to put your best drugs forward to get the highest chance for cure. And that's the attempt that's made here.
So we want to talk about cervical cancer. Kim has a case that we're going to talk about, but I want to ask this question because there's a paper that we've seen a press release, the one I'm going to show you in a second. So here's the question to the audience. Audience, the combination of chemotherapy and an anti-PD-1 antibody is one of the standard treatment options in non-small cell lung cancer, head and neck cancer, cervical cancer, or all of the above. And I think the answer to this question, we know that in lung cancer and head and neck cancer, that's a common strategy, particularly with symptomatic patients with low PD-1s, to give them a chemotherapy plus IO. So we haven't been doing that in cervical cancer. We just saw the Ruby study in endometrial cancer looking at first-line therapy. But as often the case, Tom, nowadays in oncology, the first time you hear about a positive trial is a press release that comes out. This came out in June saying there's a trial that's going to be presented. This one's called 826, or a million of these numbered trials, combining pembrolizumab which right now is being used in second line therapy with chemotherapy in the first line setting. And the trial is reportedly positive. I guess we have to see the data, but a lot of times when you see press releases like this, you can anticipate this might be changing practice. Any inside info on this, Tom, or any ideas of what this is going to mean?
Yeah, I think it's going to mean a lot. I think that this will potentially change the standard of care. I mean, we obviously need to see the numbers, but the press release is very positive. It appears that irrespective of the PD-L1 status and irrespective of whether it was combined with Bev or not, it showed a benefit. Now we have to look at those subgroups and decide what the magnitude of effect was. But in either case, I think you'll see Pembro being used in frontline cervix. So sort of GOG-240 with Bev plus an add-on now for Pembro. So again, controlling toxicity and cost are going to be issues that we'll have to deal with as well.
Let's just briefly hear about your patient, Kim. Mm-hmm. Tragically, as many of the, most of these patients are younger, often with minor children. And you look at this case and you wonder if we were to apply the paradigm we're about to do with this new trial, maybe this lady could have done a lot better because she, like most people, did not get treated first line. Anything you want to say about her and her situation, Kim?
So she unfortunately has a history of illicit drug use, which contributed to a lot of her being lost to follow-up. She relapsed back in 2019, 20, around in there, she relapsed. Then her mom, who was her main support system, passed away tragically in a car accident. So the situation got real bad real quick, and unfortunately, she did not take care of herself. Not sure it would have made much of a difference, but yeah, she unfortunately has passed away from her cervical cancer. And she had a very young child at home too.
So actually we were talking about patients with minor children in a webinar on GI cancer yesterday, because they're seeing so many patients, young patients with colorectal cancer. Yeah. Hope for the future in terms of cervical cancer. Here's another checkpoint inhibitor currently approved. And squamous cell cancer of the skin, cemiplimab. Hard to tell the difference between these checkpoint inhibitors, except the trials they do. They do the trial and it works. That's what people use. And Tom, this looks even better. I think it was a bigger trial, a more powerful statistically. It looks like they saw a lot more benefit in terms of the response rate, or maybe the response rate not higher, but at least a benefit in terms of regardless of PD-1 status. No new immune effects. Any thoughts about cemiplimab, Tom? Is that something you're going to be excited to use in the second line setting?
Yeah, it looks really promising. It's one data set, but the data set that's there looks really good. So I think people will definitely be playing with that and figuring out in their practice how their patients respond and tolerate it.
So I guess one more thing I just want to bring up, it's not immunotherapy, but you're going to be hearing about it in terms of a cervical cancer. We talk about a lot of antibody drug conjugates nowadays in oncology. There's two in HER2 positive breast cancer alone. There's one in lymphoma. There's lots of these agents where you hook on chemotherapy to a specific target and try to deliver it directly into the cell. Tom, this is another example of this, tisotumab vedotin.
Right.
Anything you want to say about how these type of drugs work and what we know about its activity?
Well, first, you did a great job of pronouncing it. I call it TV because I stumble over it. So basically, tissue factors aberrantly overexpressed in a number of cancers, especially more advanced cancers. And we see it in cervical cancer. So it's a rational target. And as you said, there's an antibody drug conjugate that binds to that. And the warhead, if you will, is a tubule damaging agent along the lines of a paclitaxel, but a different agent.
And one final question from the chat room. Pete says, how would Pembro upfront affect cemiplimab? And I think that's a very good question, Tom. This is coming out in so many cancers. There's a positive adjuvant IO trial in lung cancer, GI cancer. But, you know, some of these patients are going to relapse. So the question is, if you give it to them in the early stage, can you come back and give them immunotherapy either alone or sometimes you do combination therapy? Tom, do you ever come back and use immunotherapy in patients who relapse?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and we don't know how the landscape's going to change. For example, would people then try TV in the second line? And then cemiplimab, of course, would you then go back to that, or would you do that in the second line? I think for me, it would depend on how they responded and what the interval was from the last IO they received.
Great question. It'll also be interesting, too, to see. We talked about combining chemo with IOs. It's now being done a lot. What about combining a antibody drug conjugate where the active agent is chemo, even though you're not having much general chemo effects because it's targeted with an IO? Bladder cancer, they're all excited. They've got a antibody drug conjugate card and fortimab. They combine it with pembro. They're seeing really cool responses. We'll see whether that happens in cervical with the antibody drug conjugate like TV. Subsequent to this recording, on September 20th, 2021, the FDA granted accelerated approval to tisotumab vedotin for the treatment of recurrent or metastatic cervical cancer with disease progression on or after chemotherapy.